Side 7.
Winnie was a very young man, before he became widely known and admired. Palmer Joss had been a carnival roustabout. It was mentioned in his profile in Times Week. It was no secret. To help make his fortune, he had arranged for a map of the earth in cylindrical projection to be painstakingly tattooed on his torso. He would exhibit himself at county fairs and sideshows from Oklahoma to Mississippi, one of the stragglers and remnants of a more vigorous age of rural, itinerant entertainment. In the expanse of blue ocean were the four gods of the winds, their cheeks puffing forth, prevailing westerlies and nor'easters. By flexing his pectorals, he could make Boreas swell along with the mid-Atlantic. Then he would declaim to the astonished onlookers from Book 6 of Ovid's Metamorphoses. Monarch of islands, rolling on clouds, I toss wide waters, and I fell huge trees, possessed of demon rage I penetrate, sheer to the utmost caverns of old earth, and straining up from those unfathomed deeps, scatter the terror-stricken shades of hell, and hurl death-dealing earthquakes throughout the world. Fire and brimstone from old Rome. With some help from his hands, he would demonstrate continental drift, pressing West Africa against South America, so they joined like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle,
almost perfectly at the longitude of his navel.
They billed him as Geos, the Earthman. Joss was a great reader, and being unencumbered by a formal education past grade school, had not been told that science and classics were unseemly fare for ordinary people. Aided by his casual rumpled good looks, he would ingratiate himself with librarians in the towns along the carnival's trek and ask what serious books he should read. He wanted, he told them, to improve himself. Dutifully he read about winning friends and investing in real estate and intimidating your acquaintances without their noticing, but felt these books somehow shallow. By contrast, in ancient literature and in modern science, he thought he detected quality. When there were layovers, he would haunt the local town or county library. He taught himself some geography and history. They were job-related, he told Elvira, the elephant girl, who questioned him closely on his absences. She suspected him of compulsive dalliances. A librarian in every port, she once said. But she had to admit, his professional patter was improving. The contents were too highbrow, but the delivery was down home. Surprisingly, Joss's little stall began to make money for the carnival. His back to the audience, he was one day demonstrating the collision of India with Asia and the resulting crinkling up of the Himalayas, when out of a gray but rainless sky, a lightning bolt flashed and struck him dead. There had been twisters in southeastern Oklahoma, and the weather was unusual throughout the South. He had a perfectly lucid sense of leaving his body, pitifully crumpled on the sawdust-covered planking, being regarded with caution and something akin to awe by the small crowd, and rising, rising, as if through a long dark tunnel, slowly approaching a brilliant light. And in the radiance, he gradually discerned a figure of heroic, indeed of godlike proportions. When he awoke, he found a part of himself disappointed to be alive. He was lying on a cot, in a modestly furnished bedroom. Leaning over him was the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin, not the present incumbent of that name, but his father, a venerable surrogate preacher of the third quarter of the 20th century. In the background, Joss thought he could see a dozen hooded figures singing the Kyrie Eleison, but he couldn't be sure.
"Am I gonna live or die?"
the young man whispered.
"My boy, you're going to do both,"
the Reverend Mr. Rankin replied. Joss was soon overcome with a poignant sense of discovery at the existence of the world, but in a way that was difficult for him to articulate. This feeling was in conflict with the beatific image that he had beheld, and with the infinite joy that vision portended. He could sense the two feelings in conflict within his breast. In various circumstances, sometimes in mid-sentence, he would become aware of one or the other of these feelings making some claim on speech or action. After a while, he was content to live with both. He really had been dead, they told him afterwards. A doctor had pronounced him dead. But they had prayed over him, they had sung hymns, and they had even tried to revive him by body massage, mainly in the vicinity of Mauritania. They had returned him to life. He had been truly and literally reborn. Since this corresponded so well to his own perception of the experience, he accepted the account, and gladly. While he almost never talked about it, he became convinced of the significance of the event. He had not been struck dead for nothing. He had not been brought back for no reason. Under his patron's tutelage, he began to study scripture seriously. He was deeply moved by the idea of the resurrection and the doctrine of salvation. He assisted the Reverend Mr. Rankin at first in small ways, eventually filling in for him in the more onerous or more distant preaching assignments. Especially after the younger Billy Joe Rankin left for Odessa, Texas, in answer to a call from God. Soon Joss found a preaching style that was his own, not so much exhortatory as explanatory. In simple language and homely metaphors, he would explain baptism in the afterlife, the connection of Christian revelation with the myths of classical Greece and Rome, the idea of God's plan for the world, and the conformity of science and religion when both were properly understood. This was not the conventional preaching, and it was too ecumenical for many tastes. But it proved unaccountably popular.
"You've been reborn, Joss," the elder Rankin told him. "So you ought to change your name."
"Except Palmer Joss is such a fine name for a preacher, you'd be a fool not to keep it."
Like doctors and lawyers, the vendors of religion rarely criticize one another's wares, Joss observed. But one night he attended services at the New Church of God Crusader to hear the younger Billy Joe Rankin, triumphantly returned from Odessa, preach to the multitude. Billy Joe enunciated a stark doctrine of reward, retribution, and the rapture. But tonight was a healing night. The curative instrument, the congregation was told, was the holiest of relics, holier than a splinter of the true cross, holier even than the thigh bone of Saint Teresa of Avila, that Generalissimo Francisco Franco had kept in his office to intimidate the pious. What Billy Joe Rankin brandished was the actual amniotic fluid that surrounded and protected our Lord. The liquid had been carefully preserved in an ancient earthenware vessel that once belonged, so it was said, to Saint Anne. "The tiniest drop of it would cure what ails you," he promised, "through a special act of divine grace. This holiest of holy waters was with us tonight." Joss was appalled. Not so much that Rankin would attempt so transparent a scam, but that any of the parishioners were so credulous as to accept it. In his previous life, he had witnessed many attempts to bamboozle the public. But that was entertainment. This was different. This was religion. Religion was too important to gloss the truth, much less to manufacture miracles. He took to denouncing this imposture from the pulpit. As his fervor grew, he railed against other deviant forms of Christian fundamentalism, including those aspirant herpetologists who tested their faith by fondling snakes in accord with the biblical injunction that the pure of heart shall not fear the venom of serpents. In one widely quoted sermon, he paraphrased Voltaire. He never thought, he said, that he would find men of the cloth so venal as to lend support to the blasphemers who taught that the first priest was the first rogue who met the first fool. These religions were damaging religion. He shook his finger gracefully in the air. Joss argued that in every religion there was a doctrinal line beyond which it insulted the intelligence of its practitioners. Reasonable people might disagree as to where that line should be drawn, but religions trespassed well beyond it at their peril. People were not fools, he said. The day before his death, as he was putting his affairs in order, the elder Rankin sent word to Joss that he never wanted to lay eyes on him again. At the same time, Joss began to preach that science didn't have all the answers either. He found inconsistencies in the theory of evolution. The embarrassing findings, the facts that don't fit, the scientists just sweep under the rug, he said. They don't really know that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old any more than Archbishop Usher knew that it was 6,000 years old. Nobody has seen evolution happen. Nobody has been marking time since the creation. 200 quadrillion, Mississippi, he once imagined the patient timekeeper intoning, counting up the seconds from the origin of the world. And Einstein's theory of relativity was also unproved. You couldn't travel faster than light, no matter what, Einstein had said. How could he know? How close to the speed of light had he gone? Relativity was only a way of understanding the world. Einstein couldn't restrict what mankind could do in the far future. And Einstein sure couldn't set limits on what God could do. Couldn't God travel faster than light if he wanted to? Couldn't God make us travel faster than light if he wanted to? There were excesses in science, and there were excesses in religion. A reasonable man wouldn't be stampeded by either one. There were many interpretations of Scripture and many interpretations of the natural world. Both were created by God, so both must be mutually consistent. Wherever a discrepancy seems to exist, either a scientist or a theologian, maybe both, hasn't been doing his job. Palmer Joss combined his even-handed criticism of science and religion with a fervent plea for moral rectitude and a respect for the intelligence of his flock. In slow stages, he acquired a national reputation. In debates on the teaching of scientific creationism in the schools, on the ethical status of abortion and frozen embryos, on the admissibility of genetic engineering, he attempted in his way to steer a middle course, to reconcile caricatures of science and religion. Both contending camps were outraged at his interventions, and his popularity grew. He became a confidant of presidents. His sermons were excerpted on the op-ed pages of major secular newspapers. But he resisted many invitations and some proffered blandishments to found an electronic church. He continued to live simply, and rarely, except for presidential invitations and ecumenical congresses, left the rural South. Beyond a conventional patriotism, he made it a rule not to meddle in politics. In a field filled with competing entries, many of dubious probity, Palmer Joss became, in erudition and moral authority, the preeminent Christian fundamentalist preacher of his day. Terheer had asked if they could have a quiet dinner somewhere. He was flying in for the summary session with Vega and the Soviet delegation on the latest progress in the interpretation of the message. But South Central New Mexico was crawling with the world's press, and there was no restaurant for 100 miles in which they could talk unobserved and unheard. So she made dinner herself in her modest apartment, near the visiting scientists' quarters at the Argus facility. There was a great deal to talk about. Sometimes it seemed that the fate of the whole project was hanging by a presidential thread. But the little tremor of anticipation she felt just before Ken's arrival was occasioned, she was vaguely aware, by more than that. Joss was not exactly business, so they got around to him while loading the dishwasher. "The man is scared stiff," Ellie said. "His perspective is narrow. He imagines the message is going to be unacceptable biblical exegesis or something that shakes his faith. He has no idea about how a new scientific paradigm subsumes the previous one. He wants to know what science has done for him lately. And he's supposed to be the voice of reason.
Compared to the doomsday Kiliasts and the Earth-firsters, the Palmer Joss is the soul of moderation, Dear-Here replied. Maybe we haven't explained the methods of science as well as we should have.
I worry about that a lot these days.
And Ellie, can you really be sure that it isn't a message from God or the devil?
Ken, you can't be serious.
Well, how about advanced beings committed to what we might call good or evil, who somebody like Joss would consider indistinguishable from God or the devil?
Ken, whoever those beings are in the Vega system, I guarantee they didn't create the universe. And they're nothing like the Old Testament God. Remember, Vega, the sun, and all the other stars in the solar neighborhood are in some backwater of an absolutely humdrum galaxy. Why should I am that I am hang out around here? There must be more pressing things for him to do.
Ellie, we're in a bind. You know Joss is very influential. He's been close to 3 presidents, including the present incumbent. The president is inclined to make some concession to Joss, although I don't think she wants to put him and a bunch of other preachers on the preliminary decryption committee with you, Valerian, and Drumlin, to say nothing of Vega and his colleagues. It's hard to imagine the Russians going along with fundamentalist clergy on the committee.
The whole thing could unravel over this. So why don't we go and talk to him? The president says that Joss is really fascinated by science. Suppose we won him over.
We're going to convert Palmer Joss. I'm not imagining making him change his religion. Let's just make him understand what Argus is about. How we don't have to answer the message if we don't like what it says. How interstellar distances quarantine us from Vega.
Ken, he doesn't even believe that the velocity of light is a cosmic speed limit. We're going to be talking past each other. Also, I've got a long history of failure in accommodating to the conventional religions. I tend to blow my top at their inconsistencies and hypocrisies. I'm not sure a meeting between Joss and me is what you want, or the president.
Ellie, he said, I know who I'd put my money on. I don't see how getting together with Joss could make things much worse.
She allowed herself to return his smile.
With the tracking ships now in place, and a few small but adequate radio telescopes installed in such places as Reykjavik and Jakarta, there was now redundant coverage of the signal from Vega at every longitude swathe. A major conference was scheduled to be held in Paris of the full World Message Consortium. In preparation, it was natural for the nations with the largest fraction of the data to hold a preparatory scientific discussion. They had been meeting for the better part of 4 days, and this summary session was intended mainly to bring those such as Dürr-Here, who served as intermediaries between the scientists and the politicians, up to speed. The Soviet delegation, while nominally headed by Lunacharsky, included several scientists and technical people of equal distinction. Among them were Genrikh Arkhangelsky, recently named head of the Soviet-led International Space Consortium called Intercosmos, and Timofey Gotritsky, listed as Minister of Medium-Heavy Industry, and a member of the Central Committee. Vega clearly felt himself under unusual pressures. He had resumed chain-smoking. He held the cigarette between his thumb and forefinger, palm up as he talked.
I agree that there is adequate overlap in longitude, but I'm still worried about redundancy. A failure in the helium liquefier on board the Marshall Nedlin, or a power failure in Reykjavik, and the continuity of the message is in jeopardy. Suppose the message takes 2 years to cycle around to the beginning. If we miss a piece, we will have to wait 2 more years to fill in the gap. And remember, we don't know that the message will be repeated. If there's no repeat, the gaps will never be repaired. I think we need to plan even for unlikely possibilities.
What are you thinking of?
Dürr-Here asked. Something like emergency generators for every observatory in the consortium?
Yes, an independent amplifier. Spectrometers, autocorrelators, disk drives, and so forth at each observatory. And some provision for fast airlift of liquid helium to remote observatories, if necessary.
Ellie, do you agree? Absolutely. Anything else?
I think we should continue to observe Vega on a very broad range of frequencies,
Vega said.
Perhaps tomorrow a different message will come through on only one of the message frequencies. We should also monitor other regions of the sky. Maybe the key to the message won't come from Vega, but from somewhere else.
Let me say why I think Vega's point is important, interjected Valerian. This is a unique moment. When we're receiving a message, but have made no progress at all in decrypting it. We have no previous experience along these lines. We have to cover all the bases. We don't want to wind up a year or two from now kicking ourselves because there was some simple precaution we forgot to take or some simple measurement that we overlooked. The idea that the message will cycle back on itself is the merest guess. There's nothing in the message itself, as far as we can see, that promises cycling back. Any opportunities lost now may be lost for all time. I also agree there's more instrumental development that needs doing. For all we know, there's a fourth layer to the palimpsest. There's also the question of personnel,
Vega continued. Suppose this message goes on not for a year or two, but for decades. Or suppose this is just the first in a long series of messages from all over the sky. There are at most a few hundred really capable radio astronomers in the world. That is a very small number when the stakes are so high. The industrialized countries must start producing many more radio astronomers and radio engineers with first-rate training.
Ellie noted that Gotsrita, who had said little, was taking detailed notes. She was again struck by how much more literate the Soviets were in English than the Americans in Russian. Near the beginning of the century, scientists all over the world spoke, or at least read, German. Before that, it had been French, and before that, Latin. In another century, there might be some other obligatory scientific language, Chinese, perhaps. For the moment, it was English, and scientists all over the planet struggled to learn its ambiguities and irregularities. Lighting a fresh cigarette from the glowing tip of its predecessor, Vega went on.
There is something else to be said, though. This is just speculation. It's not even as plausible as the idea that the message will cycle back on itself, which Professor Valerian quite properly stressed was only a guess. I would not ordinarily mention so speculative an idea at such an early stage. But if the speculation is sound, there are certain further actions we must begin thinking about immediately. I would not have the courage to raise this possibility if Academician Arkhangelsky had not come tentatively to the same conclusion. He and I have disagreed about the quantization of quasar redshifts, the explanation of superluminal light sources, the rest mass of the neutrino, quark physics in neutron stars. We have had many disagreements. I must admit that sometimes he has been right and sometimes I have been right. Almost never, it seems to me, in the early speculative stage of a subject have we agreed, but on this, we agree. Genrik Dmitch, would you explain?
Arkhangelsky seemed tolerant, even amused. He and Lunacharsky had been for years engaged in personal rivalry, heated scientific disputes, and a celebrated controversy on the prudent level of support for Soviet fusion research.
We guess, he said, that the message is the instructions for building a machine. Of course, we have no knowledge about how to decode the message. The evidence is in internal references. I give you an example. Here on page 15,441 is a clear reference to an earlier page, 13,097, which, by luck, we also have. The later page was received here in New Mexico, the earlier one at our observatory near Tashkent. On page 13,097 there is another reference, this to a time when we were not covering all longitudes. There are many cases of this back-referencing. In general, and this is the important point, there are complicated instructions on a recent page, but simpler instructions on an earlier page. In one case, there are 8 citations to earlier material on a single page.
That's not an awfully compelling argument, guys, replied Ellie. Maybe it's a set of mathematical exercises, the later ones building on the earlier ones. Maybe it's a long novel. They might have very long lifetimes compared to us, in which events are connected with childhood experiences, or whatever they have on Vega when they're young. Maybe it's a tightly cross-referenced religious manual.
The 10 billion commandments,
Terhir laughed.
Maybe,
said Lunacharsky, staring through a cloud of cigarette smoke out the window at the telescopes. They seemed to be staring longingly at the sky.
But when you look at the patterns of cross-references, I think you'll agree it looks more like the instruction manual for building a machine. Ugh, God knows what the machine is supposed to do.
Chapter 9. The Numinous. Wonder is the basis of worship. Thomas Carlyle, Sartor Resartus, 1833-34. I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research. Albert Einstein, Ideas and Opinions, 1954. She could recall the exact moment when, on one of many trips to Washington, she discovered that she was falling in love with Ken Terhir. Arrangements for the meeting with Palmer Joss seemed to be taking forever. Apparently Joss was reluctant to visit the Argus facility. It was the impiety of the scientists, not their interpretation of the message, he now said, that interested him. And to probe their character, some more neutral ground was needed. Ellie was willing to go anywhere, and a special assistant to the president was negotiating. Other radio astronomers were not to go. The president wanted it to be Ellie alone. Ellie was also waiting for the day, still some weeks off, when she would fly to Paris for the first full meeting of the World Message Consortium. She and Vega were coordinating the Global Data Collection Program. The signal acquisition was now fairly routine, and in recent months there had been not one gap in the coverage. So she found to her surprise that she had a little time on her hands. She vowed to have a long talk with her mother, and to remain civil and friendly, no matter what provocation was offered. There was an absurd amount of backed-up paper and electronic mail to go through, not just congratulations and criticisms from colleagues, but religious admonitions, pseudo-scientific speculations proposed with great confidence, and fan mail from all over the world. She had not read the Astrophysical Journal in months, although she was the first author of a very recent paper that was surely the most extraordinary article that had ever appeared in that august publication. The signal from Vega was so strong that many amateurs, tired of ham radio, had begun constructing their own small radio telescopes and signal analyzers. In the early stages of message acquisition, they had turned up some useful data, and Ellie was still besieged by amateurs who thought they had acquired something unknown to the SETI professionals. She felt an obligation to write encouraging letters. There were other meritorious radio astronomy programs at the facility, the quasar survey, for example, that needed attending to. But instead of doing all these things, she found herself spending almost all her time with Ken. Of course, it was her duty to involve the president's science advisor in Project Argus as deeply as he wished. It was important that the president be fully and competently informed. She hoped the leaders of other nations would be as thoroughly briefed on the findings from Vega as was the president of the United States. This president, while untrained in science, genuinely liked the subject and was willing to support science, not only for its practical benefits, but at least a little for the joy of knowing. This had been true of few previous American leaders, since James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Still, it was remarkable how much time Jurheer was able to spend at Argus. He did devote an hour or more each day in high bandpass scrambled communications with his Office of Science and Technology Policy in the old executive office building in Washington. But the rest of the time, as far as she could see, he was simply around. He would poke into the innards of the computer system or visit individual radio telescopes. Sometimes an assistant from Washington would be with him. More often, he would be alone. She would see him through the open door of the spare office they had assigned him, his feet propped up on the desk, reading some report or talking on the phone. He would offer her a cheery wave and return to his work. She would find him talking casually with Drumlin or Valerian, but equally so with junior technicians and with the secretarial staff, who had on more than one occasion pronounced him within Ellie's hearing charming. Jurheer had many questions for her as well. At first they were purely technical and programmatic, but soon they extended to plans for a wide variety of conceivable future events, and then to untrammeled speculation. These days it almost seemed that discussion of the project was only a pretext to spend a little time together. One fine autumn afternoon in Washington, the president was obliged to delay a meeting of the Special Contingency Task Group because of the Tyrone Free crisis. After an overnight flight from New Mexico, Ellie and Jurheer found themselves with an unscheduled few hours and decided to visit the Vietnam Memorial, designed by Maya Ying Lin when she was still an undergraduate architectural student at Yale. Amidst the somber and doleful reminders of a foolish war, Jurheer seemed inappropriately cheerful, and Ellie began again to speculate about flaws in his character. A pair of General Service Administration plainclothes security people, their custom-molded flesh-colored earpieces in place, followed discreetly. He had coaxed an exquisite blue caterpillar to climb aboard a twig. It briskly padded along, its iridescent body rippling with the motion of 14 pairs of feet. At the end of the twig, it held on with its last 5 segments and flailed the air in a plucky attempt to find a new perch. Unsuccessful, it turned itself around smartly and retraced its many steps. Jurheer then changed his clutch on the twig so that when the caterpillar returned to its starting point, there was again nowhere to go. Like some caged mammalian carnivore, it paced back and forth many times, but in the last few passages it seemed to her with increasing resignation. She was beginning to feel pity for the poor creature, even if it proved to be, say, the larva responsible for the barley blight. "What a wonderful program in this little guy's head," he exclaimed. "It works every time. Optimum escape software. And he knows not to fall off. I mean, the twig is effectively suspended in air. The caterpillar never experiences that in nature because the twig is always connected to something." "Ellie, did you ever wonder what that program would feel like if it was in your head? I mean, would it just seem obvious to you what you had to do when you came to the end of a twig? Would you have the impression you were thinking it through? Would you wonder how you knew to shake your front 10 feet in the air but hold on tight with the other 18? She inclined her head slightly and examined him rather than the caterpillar. He seemed to have little difficulty imagining her as an insect. She tried to reply noncommittally, reminding herself that for him this would be a matter of professional interest. "What do you do with it now?" "I'll put it back down in the grass, I guess." "What else would you do with it?" "Some people might kill it. It's hard to kill a creature once it lets you see its consciousness." He continued to carry both twig and larva. They walked for a while in silence, past almost 55,000 names engraved in reflecting black granite. "Every government that prepares for war paints its adversaries as monsters," she said. "They don't want you thinking of the other side as human. If the enemy can think and feel, you might hesitate to kill them. And killing is very important. Better to see them as monsters." "Yeah, look at this beauty," he replied after a moment. Really, look closely. She did. Fighting back a small tremor of revulsion, she tried to see it through his eyes. Watch what it does, he continued. If it was as big as you or me, it would scare everybody to death. It would be a genuine monster, right? But it's little. It eats leaves, minds its own business, and adds a little beauty to the world. She took the hand not preoccupied with the caterpillar, and they walked wordlessly past the ranks of names inscribed in chronological order of death. These were, of course, only the American casualties. Except in the hearts of their families and friends, there was no comparable memorial anywhere on the planet for the 2 million people of Southeast Asia who had also died in the conflict. In America, the most common public comment about this war was about political hamstringing of military power, psychologically akin, she thought, to the stab-in-the-back explanation by German militarists of their World War I defeat. The Vietnam War was a pustule on the national conscience that no president so far had the courage to lance. Subsequent policies of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had not made this task easier. She remembered how common it was for American soldiers to call their Vietnamese adversaries gooks, slopeheads, slant eyes, and worse. Could we possibly manage the next phase of human history without first dealing with this penchant for dehumanizing the adversary? In everyday conversation, Jurheer didn't talk like an academic. If you met him at the corner newsstand buying a paper, you'd never guess he was a scientist. He hadn't lost his New York street accent. At first, the apparent incongruity between his language and the quality of his scientific work seemed amusing to his colleagues. As his research and the man himself became better known, his accent became merely idiosyncratic. But his pronunciation of, say, guanosine triphosphate seemed to give this benign molecule explosive properties. They had been slow in recognizing that they were falling in love. It must have been apparent to many others. A few weeks before, when Lunacharsky was still at Argus, he launched himself on one of his occasional tirades on the irrationality of language. This time, it was the turn of American English. Ellie, why do people say, make the same mistake again? What does again add to the sentence? And am I right that burn up and burn down mean the same thing? Slow up and slow down mean the same thing? So if screw up is acceptable, why not screw down? She nodded wearily. She had heard him more than once complain to his Soviet colleagues on the inconsistencies of the Russian language, and was sure she would hear a French edition of all this at the Paris conference. She was happy to admit that languages had infelicities, but they had so many sources and evolved in response to so many small pressures that it would be astonishing if they were perfectly coherent and internally consistent. Vege had such a good time complaining, though, that she ordinarily did not have the heart to remonstrate with him.
And take this phrase, head over heels in love, he continued. This is a common expression, yes, but it's exactly backward, or rather upside down. You are ordinarily head over heels. When you are in love, you should be heels over head. Am I right? You would know about falling in love. But whoever invented this phrase did not know about love. He imagined you walk around in the usual way, instead of floating upside down in the air like the work of that French painter. What's his name?
He was Russian, she replied. Marc Chagall had provided a narrow pathway out of a somewhat awkward conversational thicket. Afterward, she wondered if Vege had been teasing her or probing for a response. Perhaps he had only unconsciously recognized the growing bond between Ellie and Jurheer. At least part of Jurheer's reluctance was clear. Here he was, the president's science advisor, devoting an enormous amount of time to an unprecedented, delicate, and volatile matter. To become emotionally involved with one of the principals was risky. The president certainly wanted his judgment unimpaired. He should be able to recommend courses of action that Ellie opposed, and to urge rejection of options that she supported. Falling in love with Ellie would, on some level, compromise Drahir's effectiveness. For Ellie, it was more complicated. Before she had acquired the somewhat staid respectability of the directorship of a major radio observatory, she had had many partners. While she had felt herself in love and declared herself so, marriage had never seriously tempted her. She dimly remembered the quatrain, was it William Butler Yeats, with which she had tried to reassure her early swains, heartbroken because, as always, she had determined that the affair was over. You say there is no love, my love, unless it lasts for a... Ah, folly, there are episodes far better than the play. She recalled how charming John Stoughton had been to her while courting her mother, and how easily he had cast off this pose after he became her stepfather. Some new and monstrous persona, hitherto barely glimpsed, could emerge in men shortly after you married them. Her romantic predispositions made her vulnerable, she thought. She was not going to repeat her mother's mistake. A little deeper was a fear of falling in love without reservation, of committing herself to someone who might then be snatched from her, or simply leave her. But if you never really fall in love, you can never really miss it. She did not dwell on this sentiment, dimly aware that it did not ring quite true. Also, if she never really fell in love with someone, she could never really betray him, as in her heart of hearts she felt that her mother had betrayed her long-dead father. She still missed him terribly. With Ken, it seemed to be different, or had her expectations been gradually compromised over the years. Unlike many other men she could think of, when challenged or stressed, Ken displayed a gentler, more compassionate side. His tendency to compromise and his skill in scientific politics were part of the accoutrements of his job. But underneath, she felt she had glimpsed something solid. She respected him for the way he had integrated science into the whole of his life, and for the courageous support for science that he had tried to inculcate into two administrations. They had, as discreetly as possible, been staying together more or less in her small apartment at Argus. Their conversations were a joy, with ideas flying back and forth like shuttlecocks. Sometimes, they responded to each other's uncompleted thoughts with almost perfect foreknowledge. He was a considerate and inventive lover, and anyway, she liked his pheromones. She was sometimes amazed at what she was able to do and say in his presence because of their love. She came to admire him so much that his love for her affected her own self-esteem. She liked herself better because of him. And since he clearly felt the same, there was a kind of infinite regress of love and respect underlying their relationship. At least, that was how she described it to herself. In the presence of so many of her friends, she had felt an undercurrent of loneliness. With Ken, it was gone. She was comfortable describing to him her reveries, snatches of memories, childhood embarrassments. And he was not merely interested, but fascinated. He would question her for hours about her childhood. His questions were always direct, sometimes probing, but without exception, gentle. She began to understand why lovers talk baby talk to one another. There was no other socially acceptable circumstance in which the children inside her were permitted to come out. If the 1-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 12-year-old, and the 20-year-old all find compatible personalities in the beloved, there is a real chance to keep all of these sub-personas happy. Love ends their long loneliness. Perhaps the depth of love can be calibrated by the number of different selves that are actively involved in a given relationship. With her previous partners, it seemed, at most, one of these selves was able to find a compatible opposite number. The other personas were grumpy hangers-on. End of side 7.